This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
There is something special about listening to musicians talk about Dylan. We recently spoke with Robin Hitchcock and Wesley Stace, two songwriters and musicians that have long been known as Dylan fans. I think they clearly showed that as performers, songwriters, and musicians, people have covered Dylan songs live hundreds of times and do what he does, that they have the insights and ability to share them in ways that are just different from what we hear as authors, fans, or academics. If you haven't heard those episodes, especially the full extended editions, I really recommend them. Today's conversation is with another musician, songwriter, and performer who is a massive Bob Dylan fan. I've seen Jeff Slate open for Ramblin' Jack Elliott. I saw him interview Roger McGuinn at the first Bob Dylan conference in Tulsa a few years ago, and I've seen him do Dylan tribute shows. We had a fantastic conversation about Time Out of Mind that you're about to hear. Jeff has released solo albums, opened for Sheryl Crow, he's a frequent music journalist, and his writing has appeared in Rolling Stone, Esquire, The New Yorker, and many other places. He's also a regular host on Sirius XM. And significant to all of us, Jeff Slate wrote the liner notes for the More Blood, More Tracks edition of the Bootleg series. I asked Jeff to talk about Time Out of Mind, and as you'll hear, he had stories and thoughts that go all the way back to release day in September 1997. He talks about the sound of the album, the risks that that kind of production produced, and much more. And he tells us about how he approaches and appreciates seeing Dylan live. Here's our Time Out of Mind talk with Jeff Slate.
All right, Jeff. Well, first, thanks for joining us today. Really happy to have you from the far side of Manhattan.
Yes, the good side.
I'm excited to have you here for a bunch of reasons. Star on your resume is having written liner notes for a bootleg series, which is pretty awesome. And it was your great, is it Rolling Pod that you were on? The thing that triggered me was you said you had kind of winked at the Dylan office and said, if there's a Time Out of Mind box, I want to write it. And I thought, oh, this guy's got thoughts about Time Out of Mind. I want to hear him.
I do.
I want to hear him.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. The first time, you know, when you, if you're on their radar, you sort of get, and you're in New York City particularly, you get invited in. And so I think I had written a review about another self-portrait, maybe. And so I got asked in for coffee, and it was really fun. You know, it's always, you know, it's exciting as a Dylan fan. People there are amazing. And when I was getting up to leave, I thought, well, I may never see these people ever again. So I said, hey, if you're ever, because it was around the time of maybe the 20th anniversary or the, no, it would have been 15th anniversary. It was quite a while ago. And I was like, oh, hey, you know, if you ever do Time Out of Mind, I'd love to be the guy. And, you know, whatever stupid thing I said, but, you know, that turned into, they ended up not doing Time Out of Mind back then, but that turned into sort of a dance over a couple of years. That turned into a phone call. I was literally on the bus after parent-teacher conferences at my kid's school, and my phone rang, and they were like, hey, can you be here, you know, before we close, which was, you know, it was like regular office hours, like 4 to 5. There was no way I was going to get there by 5. And I thought, you know, I'm blowing this. Whatever it is, it sounded urgent. Okay, can you be over here first thing tomorrow? And, you know, told me what it was about. This is long before, you know, the public knew what was going on. And it was so exciting. Like that night, I couldn't sleep. I had, you know, talk about, I had thoughts about Time Out of Mind. It was like everything. I pulled out all the bootlegs and I was like trying, you know, making a playlist. And I'm trying, like, I wanted to go in there, have really coherent thoughts. And, you know, it was similar to when I did the Sgt. Pepper project. It was, you know, I wasn't auditioning for it. They'd already decided if I wanted to do it, I could do it. Just to me, as like you, as a fan, it's like, how do you get asked to do this kind of thing? You know? So wow. It was a real honor and very, very exciting. And still is.
how are you feeling about things, you know, before World Gone Wrong, after World Gone Wrong? What did you expect from Bob in the next 10 years?
You know, obviously he'd been in the Wilburys and there was a lot going on in the 10 or so years prior. I saw him in both 95 and 96. I remember 96 being a really good show relative to shows of that era. You know, there's a huge difference between 96 and 97. And then there's a huge leap again between say 97 and 99, 2000, you know, I mean, those shows around.
And from 91 were kind of the low part of that. 95 was, you know, Europe was incredible.
Right.
So yeah, I do think the live stuff, you know, going to work in 88 and saying, I'm going to figure out live. He had it by then. I agree.
That's awesome. I think too, look, I had seen the first time I'd seen Bob was with the Heartbreakers in 86. And I was just in the thrall of being in the room with Bob Dylan and also seeing him with the Heartbreakers. And, you know, one of the things, it's easy for us to say now, oh, 95 was a good year, 96 was a good year, 2000 was a good year. At the time, the years that we now consider bad years were great fucking years. Because it, for me, as a young musician trying to sort of find his way as a player and a songwriter and in this business, to see Bob Dylan doing his thing, even on nights that we now consider weren't that great, fucking tremendous. You know, I mean, so I think it's all relative. It's like, you know, I'm not a big fan of, like, I don't read a lot of Bob Dylan books. I don't obsess over, you know, what cigarettes he was smoking or what clothes he was wearing or who he was playing with necessarily. I like to take Bob, and I said this the first time I went to the office, I like to take Bob the way he presents himself. So if I go on a particular night and he's good or bad or, you know, even phoning it in for that matter, I try to find the things I can appreciate in what he's trying to accomplish as a performer or an artist that night. And I think if you approach him that way, the rewards are sort of exponential, because when you get a great night, it'll completely blow you away, even if you've seen him a couple of hundred times. So I think for me, you know, I saw him in I want to say 96 in Providence with Jewel of all things. And she came out and did I Shall Be Released at the end. And, you know, and I remember the guy I was with was pretty indifferent about the show. And I thought it was a great show, you know, and I, you know, I've gone back and I've listened to the bootlegs and it, you know, it was an okay show, but you know, I think when you're in the room with Bob Dylan, there's a certain magic that you don't get from those bootlegs or even YouTube. You know, back then, you could get really close. You know, I remember going to see him in 2000. And I was literally at the lip of the stage in a basketball auditorium at URI. I was less than 10 feet from Bob Dylan, and he played the guitar the whole night, played the harmonica, sang. I could see the lines on his face, the seams on his jacket. I was like totally mesmerized. And I learned something, you know, about the way he plays, the way he approaches the songs, the way, you know. So I think, to backtrack and kind of answer your question, given the fact that we had gotten those two acoustic records, which I love because it was so different than what everybody else, certainly his peers, were trying to accomplish at that point. They were so contrary. The song choices were contrary, but they were immediate and they were really special if you wanted to spend the time and listen to them. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, casual fans especially, got them, put them on, listened to a couple of tracks and just, you know, they went to the CD bin, the used CD bin. And I really devoured them. So when Time Out of Mind came out, I was, you know, the first guy when J&R Music opened downtown, that had a temp job down there. When they opened the doors and they were, the guy was literally putting them out, grabbed it, paid for it, took it outside, popped it in my CD player, and I didn't go back to work because the first 15 seconds was so magical and so arresting. Voice, the sound, you know, it was not remotely what I expected, but it was also, I knew, you know, right from the first minute or two that the record itself was going to be great. Not just Bob's performances, that the songs were going to be great, but that it was like a whole other thing that he had yet again was doing something he'd never done before. And so, you know, that this was really the beginning of him going back to that, you know, America, you know, that early American music sound. This was him testing the waters with a producer to get to that Jack, the next iteration, which was Jack Frost iteration. So I was just like, I went to City Hall Park and I sat there with my CD player. Batteries ran out. I got more batteries. I listened to it again. I was just like, that was it for me that day. I was, you know, I was toast. It was going to be time out of mind for the rest of the day.
Wow, that's amazing. A, that you remember that clearly, but that you, you know, that experience kind of, you know, opening day. I remember the Love and Theft Day. Obviously, it was 9/11 and all that. More like the opening day. I don't remember Tomb opening day quite so much myself. Yeah, it's a powerful,
you know,
start.
I think for,
you know, there's also some noodling.
Yeah. I think for all of us, you have to remember, you know, and this is no disrespect to Bob Dylan or Sony or anybody, but I think most of us had fairly low expectations for a new Bob Dylan record. You know, I think.
Oh, no, this is the point. I think this is what's interesting. Because if you look at it, and I, you know, I do obsess over the details more than you probably, but, you know, it was 7 years since a new song, you know, and the case I just made in an earlier version of this podcast, you know, 1977 when Street Legal came out, was not perfection, was not everyone loved it, was not, you know, and then he, you know, the Born Again years, you know, he got, so he had almost 20 years of not, you know, you can do everything right. And so the expectations weren't high. And then this is kind of the, oh, let's turn another corner because we're, you know, doing it differently and back and unexpected and a new sound and, you know, a new voice and a.
And I think what's most remarkable about that is he was not. That was a problem that he and his peer had been having, you know, certainly throughout the 80s and the early 90s, most of the people that he came up with who were in the, now in their 40s and 50s were really struggling to find their groove. You know, McCartney had a fallow period. George Harrison just went away for a couple of years. You know, it took them, each of them, finding a collaborator. You know, McCartney found Elvis Costello. George found Jeff Lynne and the Wilburys later. You know, Fogerty wouldn't. I'm talking to John Fogerty the other day for something, and you know, I said the first time I saw him was on the Zombie tour, which, you know, he wouldn't play CCR songs then. He was playing this kind of weird electronic. I mean, he was in a bad place both personally and creatively, and yet for me it was John Fogerty. Like, it was really cool. I kind of dug that he was playing the old tune, right? And it was a good band and it was a fun show. But, you know, we all wanted somebody like Paul McCartney to write Veronica or George Harrison to write When We Was Fab or This Is Love. We wanted those guys to succeed. And when they didn't, it kind of hurt. You know, it was, when did Neil do Silver and Gold? Roughly, I think, well, what was that, like 2000, Harvest Moon and Silver and Gold. You know, those records were sort of when he turned the corner to that same, in the same way that Bob did. So I think, you know, we'd gone through this long period where he worked with the Heartbreakers, he worked with the Wilburys, he toured with the Dead. Some of those were successful, some of those were not. So we were just kind of, oh, a new Bob Dylan album, cool. So to buy it and have it be competitive with everything, not just his peers, but literally everything else in the charts, was, well, I knew it right away when I put it on. I knew from the opening notes that this was, you know, this was a guy who was once again, like with Blood on the Track, as I say in that book, throwing down the gauntlet. Like, you think I'm finished, you think I'm done? No, I got shit to say.
So let's talk about that, the sound a little bit, the production, and
sure.
You know, your either your initial or where you know after all these years, what you think of it. Obviously, they, you know, it sounds different. The songwriting style is different. The use of old material, both inspiration and quotes. But that sound, you know, and people still don't even know what it is. What hits you as a, you know, as a recording artist about what they did on that album?
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, there was, you know, there were bands like, you know, I'm thinking like Whiskey Town and Wilco and people like that who were trading in that kind of Americana sound, but it was a much more, in my mind, it was much more refined Americana sound. It was a more CCR Neil Young Americana sound. It was much less, much more Neil Young than the band. And I think, you know, what was happening here was, you know, Daniel Lanois, to his credit, you know, sometimes by all accounts against Bob's wishes, getting sounds that were baked onto the tape. Like, you know, when they go back and they wanted to remix this, a lot of those things, like the Sly and Robbie session, they're there forever. It's the way they were recorded, you know? And so, you know, he wanted to create an atmosphere that was, you couldn't remove from the record. That the songs, the way the band was performing, the way Bob Dylan was singing, the way he was delivering those lyrics was part and parcel to the sound they were hearing in their headphones while they were playing. So if it was swampy or eerie or creepy or, you know, so, you know, out of balance, you know, there were some things were really loud and some things were really soft that don't make sense to a normal recording engineer or producer. But those choices drove, in my mind, the way forward for the record, you know, in the record. And also, you know, we're completely different to, I mean, people say, you know, it's like people talk about the Beatles and how they were doing things first. You can always point to an independent artist who was making records that sounded like Time Out of Mind before Time Out of Mind. But we're talking about an artist who's a, you know, big bold letters, all capital letters, Bob Dylan, you know, an A-level artist who was really putting something out there that did not sound like anything else that was in the top 10, 40, 50, 200. So it was a really risky thing to do. And I think for him to, you know, nothing's the musicianship, you know, the parts aren't really clearly defined. They all kind of blend into each other to create a larger whole. Like you said, you know, he was writing. It was like when McCartney shifted to writing for Wing. He wasn't writing like Paul McCartney and the Beatles anymore. It's very, very hard as a songwriter to not write the way you know how to write. And yet Bob, who had taken this, you know, left turn several times over the year, okay, well, now I'm going to write a country. Now I'm going to write a gospel song. And it's not just like, you know, they're not unsuccessful attempts. This is like a guy who can write one of the greatest gospel songs ever or one of the greatest country songs ever. And so, you know, when he's now approaching this kind of early American Americana sound, he's creating or recreating a genre that everybody else is now going to replicate. You know, the next Wilco record, the next Billy Bragg record. You know, you think of any of your favorite sort of Americana sound bands from that era, Yo La Tengo, you know, everybody started to sound, they're not saying they're Americana, but, you know, that everybody was like, oh, I want some of that. I want, you know, like everybody was aping the Joshua Tree after Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno did that successfully, or after Achtung Baby, everybody wanted to, you know, was buying Neu records and you know, Kraftwerk and that kind of Joy Division. You know, similarly, after the Wilburys, everybody went back and you know, rediscovered ELO, everybody forgotten ELO by, you know, 1988, 89, 90, all of a sudden George Harrison has a big hit and people were like, oh, those are really well-crafted pop records. There are things I don't like about it necessarily, but they're really, this guy, he's a great songwriter and producer in his own right. Look what he's doing for these other guys, Tom Petty, George Harrison, the Wilburys. It's like, you know, Roy Orbison. So I think, you know, Bob was doing that and you know, he probably could have done it without Daniel Lanois, but Daniel Lanois was facilitating the mood in my, and this is again, in my mind, he was facilitating the mood he was hearing from those songs when Bob performed them to him as demo. You know, some of those songs, by my understanding, some of those songs were recorded, I think most of them were recorded as perhaps masters or demos with like a regular band and Ronnie Wood. And how different would they have sounded if they were given a more traditional rock and roll Stonesy kind of vibe? You know, they wouldn't have, they would have been, they're still great songs, but to have that, you know, arresting nature when just when you drop the needle on the first song, to have everything in my world stop, you know, when that's, and Bob, you know, the new, like you said, it starts off with the noodling and then the band kicks in and then Bob starts to sing and he doesn't sound, I mean, it's obviously Bob Dylan, but he doesn't sound like, it sounds like another worldly Bob Dylan. And it was like, okay, I'm paying attention. And I think that was something that was really crucial about Time Out of Mind. Everybody, you know, not that everybody had the same experience as me, but I think everybody stopped and listened to Bob Dylan again in a way they hadn't in a very, very long time.
Yeah. Did you have a formulation in mind for approaching liner notes for Time Out of Mind? Or you just knew you cared about the record?
I had a story to tell, which is a lot of what we're discussing here, which is my first impression of that record and my memory of that day are crucial because I think like with Blood on the Tracks, my experience of playing Idiot Wind to a crowd and, you know, just being able to remember all the words, people thought it was an achievement. And I remember walking home and feeling like I didn't even come close to doing that song justice. I think as a musician, my ears probably hear those songs a little bit differently. You know, I mean, the first time you hear anything, you're just a fan listening to a new record. But as you dig into it and you know, it's not just that first 30 seconds, you realize it's, you know, a 60 minutes worth of new Bob Dylan music that's at that, every song is at that level. Even the songs that aren't your favorite are at that level. I think, you know, it's something that you continue to listen to. And I thought that was where I wanted to start the essay with, you know, that moment and that day in the park and that experience with those songs for the very first time. And really not being able to stop listening to that record for an extended period of time, and then how my relationship with it grew over the years. And then obviously I would have had to deal with whatever, you know, whatever is actually in the box set, which is, you know, a whole other conversation.
It's extremely interesting because there are very different early versions, as you know, as you said, there's different versions of every song, but the interesting thing about Lanois, which I think you referenced in terms of his impact, I mean, it's obviously his sound and, you know, him and Mark Howard, the engineer, had a dramatic mm-hmm. impact on it. I think the fact that he was willing to sort of go toe-to-toe with Bob and push and fight for his opinion. I don't think he won all the fights, and Mark shared some stories about that with us, but, you know, he had a major influence on it and is, you know, I'm sure responsible. I don't know individual sounds and all that, but being willing to stand up to Bob, who's a guy that, you know, you've got to imagine in life doesn't get that a whole lot. So he kind of fought for it to be that way. And I mean, I think we definitely have to give him, you know, give him credit. he was his last producer since, right? 25 years, no other producers. Do you think Bob benefits or loses something? Do you think not having someone in the room to add a new direction or push something hurts? So how do you feel about the Jack Frost production?
Look, he's made now half a dozen eight records since then that are great records. You know, that stand up with his best work. Some, as a producer, more successful than others. He sort of seems, until Rough and Rowdy Ways in particular, had seemed to me to be refining a sound. You know, that Love and Theft led to a little edgier sound with Together Through Life. And then Modern Times was much more, I think, what he was trying to achieve. You know, it's like, it seemed to be each one was a little bit different, but also the next rung on the ladder as a producer, you know, wearing his producer hat. The songs are a whole other conversation. You know, I prefer Time Out of Mind to Love and Theft. I know most people do not. I've had this conversation many, many times with Dylan heads and Dylanologists. And look, I think Love and Theft is a beautiful sounding record, incredibly well produced and incredibly well recorded from an engineering standpoint. And the songs are fantastic. But to me, it's Bob Dylan doing the best version of Bob Dylan at that moment in time. And I think what for me was a little bit, you know, had the little bit of special sauce on Time Out of Mind was it was Bob Dylan being a little bit bigger than even Bob Dylan, you know, because those songs weren't just Bob Dylan's songs. They were, you know, a lot of people have covered those songs on Time Out of Mind because they're great songs that anybody can play. You don't have to have that swampy sound. And so let me backtrack to the original part of the question, which was, you know, does he benefit from producer? Everybody benefits from producer. I love producing myself. I like challenging myself as a producer and performer. But I know that when I work with somebody who says, man, this is great, and then says, you know what, maybe we should try this. And you're like, well, but you said it was great. Paul McCartney's best record in the last, since working with Elvis on Flowers in the Dirt, is the record he made with Nigel Godrich, who produces Radiohead. By all accounts, McCartney hated that experience because Nigel Godrich told him, do it again. He came in with his song. He had his 15 or 20 songs. And Nigel Godrich said, oh, there's five. These are not very good. Rework them, write some more, whatever. And, you know, nobody tells Paul McCartney those 15 songs aren't that good, and that the five that he did have that he liked needed work. But that record, Chaos and Creation, is a fantastic record. It isn't just beautifully recorded. The quality of McCartney's playing, musicianship, as well as the quality of the songs, not all of which I love, but just the level of songwriting is consistent throughout. And that's because somebody told him, like George Martin would, yeah, that's okay, do it again. And I think that's a really important thing for any artist when they walk into the studio to have somebody there who can say to them, this is good, but I think it can be greater. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I love Rough and Rowdy Ways. I love all the records between Love and Theft and Rough and Rowdy Ways a lot. And I listen to them just as much as Time Out of Mind. Time Out of Mind can sometimes feel like a mood album, you know, like it has a particular, it evokes a certain feeling, whereas the other records are much more, to my mind, a little more straightforward, you know, a little more straightforward rock and roll records or pre-rock and roll records, if you want, post-rock and roll records, if you will. So I think they're easier to put on, you know, like Love and Theft is a much easier record to put on in the car and go for a drive. For me, that doesn't make it better or worse. It's just a different iteration of it's Bob Dylan in, you know, 2000-2001, whereas Time Out of Mind was just a couple years prior. So again, I can find things I absolutely love. And, you know, if you said you had to pick one Bob Dylan record on a desert island, I absolutely couldn't do it. You know, it just couldn't happen, because there are eight different Bob Dylan. Which Bob Dylan are we talking about? Are we talking about country Bob or gospel Bob, or, you know, the, you know, folky Bob or electric Bob or pre-electric Bob, or, you know, there's like so many versions of Bob with the band or Bob, you know, it's like, it's crazy. So I think that's what is so special about Time on a Mind, is that it came out of left field, that he did allow somebody to at least share the reins with him. And the results are, you know, just different enough to what he would have gotten on his own, that it makes it, you know, not just a curio in his catalog, but something that stands completely apart on its own as a brilliant album that could be by anybody. You know, if you don't like, I know a lot of people who are not Bob Dylan fans who bought that because it was the big record of the moment. And, you know, they still listen to that record to this day. And you couldn't get them to listen to Time Out of Mind or Together with Life. Just wouldn't interest in them.
Let's maybe jump into some of the songs. So,
sure.
Well, first, you commented on the, you know, first 15 seconds of Lovesick. Overall, as a song, you said maybe it's not your favorite song, and, you know, now this is about rating or whatever, but what else comes to mind about that song, you know, maybe other than the Victoria's Secret commercial, but the sound and the, you know, that set the tone.
I think that's the key thing. It, you know, it's sort of the mission statement of the record, that you're going to hear Bob's voice, you're going to be able to hear the lyric. The music is not going to be super defined or in your face. It isn't going to be that brick wall sound that we had all become so used to in the late 90s. It's going to be a very ethereal experience. I think, you know, the other thing that strikes me about that song is, you know, the lyrics are just so good. You know, this is Bob Dylan at his absolute best. And that, you know, when people have pointed out to me, you know, there are occasional, like, what they feel are throwaway lines. I don't agree with that at all. I don't think any line is a throwaway line in a Bob Dylan song, first of all, because it's either done for effect, to get your attention, or maybe Bob's just so fucking funny and people don't realize how funny he is. And I think, you know, people have sort of figured that out more now, but certainly back in 1997, nobody was thinking of Bob Dylan as you know, song and dance man anymore. And I think it was a good reminder that if he's going to have these the Moon and June line were certainly there for effect, because every line that is, you know, on par with great literature, you've got to have this sort of, you know, lifesaver, or the chewing gum next to it, the bubble gum next to it, that keeps your brain paying attention. You know, it's like, if you give them too much of a good thing, it's overwhelming. And I think, so I think that's a, in my mind, that's a songwriting play. But what do I know? He's Bob Dylan.
Robin Hitchcock made a similar point to me, that about pairing the philosophical lines with, in his case, a very detailed, nuanced attribute of something, a very focused observation. That's what he noticed from Bob. You know, he doesn't just hit you with the philosophy and the big thoughts, but he makes it very personal at the same time.
See, I think it's the other way around. I think Bob hits you with the philosophy to distract you from the fact that he's given you something personal. I actually think it's the reverse. You know, I think when he gets a little too close to the vest, too close to the bone, he will then be, okay, well, I'm Bob Dylan. I can give you something that's going to make you, that you can chew on, that's going to distract you from the fact that I just lifted the veil just a tiny little bit. That's, you know, I see it in the reverse, but no disrespect to Robin. I just see it.
Yeah,
sure.
To some degree, it's the same point. It's, you know, what the motivation is behind it. I don't know, but that is a songwriter.
He's
talking as a songwriter, right? That you don't want to, if you're he said exactly what you said. If you stay at this philosophical level all the time, it's just kind of boring. The stripping those personal things in, which you would think abstractly would ruin it, but it enables it and makes it better.
Right.
What other songs? There's, you know, four or five masterpieces and four or five damn near ones.
Yeah.
What are the ones that catch you on there?
Well, so I'm, you know, just, I have the track list posted here. So, you know, I mean, Love Sick certainly stands out. A Million Miles stands out. Trying to Get to Heaven stands out. Not Dark Yet stands out. Cold Iron Bound, which, you know, I liked on the record, but was explosive live, you know, just, you know, completely blew me away when I saw him on that tour.
And that, there's that live version that is live on Telltale Signs in it.
That is amazing. But every night was a little bit different too, which I really love. Make You Feel My Love, Can't Wait. And Highlands, just because, you know, it's just funny. You know, I mean, it was like it took up a whole side of the record, and it's just, you know, it's like if people didn't understand that Bob Dylan was funny after listening to Highlands, they were never going to get Bob Dylan. You know, you're in the sort of Clinton Halen land if you can't laugh with Bob and a little bit at Bob, which I think is important. But if I had to pick one from those that I mentioned, I pretty much went through the track listing there, which are all really meaningful in different ways to me. The one I would pick out, because some of those, you know, Make You Feel My Love, even Not Dark Yet, Lovesick, they're a little bit more pop songs. You know, they're songs that Adele, Billy Joel, those kind of people can cover and cover in a way that feels like they're just covering a great song. It's not like they're reaching for the heights of Bob Dylan, or they're, you know, they needed an extra song, or, you know, whatever. They're doing it for the sort of car crash attraction of they're doing a Bob Dylan song. I mean that in a good way, just getting people to pay attention. Those are great songs that any, you know, you can go to a, you know, you or I could go up to the Algonquin and see some, you know, jazz trio doing any of those songs just as much as we could see Betty LaVette or Wilco do those songs, or like I said, Adele. But for me, the one that stands out among those is Standing in the Doorway, because it's all of the things I just said, but it's a song, in my mind, it's a song only Bob. I, you know, people can take issue with that or umbrage with that. I understand that.
Well, dive deeper. Tell me why. Tell me what you see in it that's different. Because this is, as you and I talked about before, this is where you can see things that I could love it, and I love the other ones. I could never tell you what's different about it or why. So share some of your thoughts.
Well, first of all, that he's willing to go on for 8 minutes, you know, and there's no, you know, if and again, this is no disrespect to Neil Young, but if you get an 8 minute Neil Young song, 2/3 of it is solo, right? There's no solos in Standing in the Doorway. It's Bob who I'm going to bet, I don't know this, but I'm going to bet it was like, you know, like a Rolling Stone, or, you know, I did a research, a paper for the Dylan Center on Band of the Hand, of all songs. And I saw the original written lyrics, Band of the Hand. And there's like, it's like a Rolling Stone. It's like a commentary on the 1980s. All the verses he didn't use are, you know, Reagan era diatribe that he discarded for this kind of throwaway soundtrack. And it could have, you know, what that song could have been, most of it's on the cutting room floor. And I'm just like, how does he do that? What I'm guessing with Standing on the Doorway is there were probably 20 or 30 verses. And from that, he called the 3, 4, they're 5, right? And as somebody who, you know, I've performed a bunch of Bob Dylan songs, and Tweeter and the Monkey Man or you know, like a Rolling Stone or any of those, you know, Just Like a Woman or, you know, Subterranean Homesick Blues, you know, when you have, those are not necessarily complicated songs. You have to find the story in them to be able to perform them, to be able to not just remember the words, but get inside them. Tangled Up in Blues is an excellent example. You have to stop thinking in a linear manner. You have to start thinking in terms of that the past and the present and the future are all happening at the same time. And then you kind of get where he's going with that, so that you can remember not just the words, but the order they come in. Because, you know, you can easily mix up the verses. I find that that's less true of Standing in the Doorway, but I think it's one of these songs that the more you dig into the lyrics, the more it feels like only Bob Dylan could write those words in the same way that, and deliver them in a way that really does them justice. And I'll give you a contrary example, which is, you know, Leonard Cohen has many amazing songs, but many of them too, only he could deliver and do them justice. You know, I think that's true. And I'm going to get a call from David Crosby if he sees this. I think that's true of Joni Mitchell. You know, I think when I hear other people do some of those songs, they're great because they're a great song, but only Joni can really own them. Standing in the Doorway for me is not Make You Feel My Love. You know, Make You Feel My Love, I could do it tonight. I've done it. You know, I backed people on it. You know, any lounge singer could do Make You Feel My Love and have the couples in the audience holding hands. Whereas Standing in the Doorway is a different animal. You know, you could, if you really spent some time to get it down and commit yourself to it, I'm not saying any great performer couldn't do it justice. I'm just saying that there's something about Bob's delivery of those words, his ownership of the story, elevates it in a way that I think it would be very hard for other artists to do justice. That help?
It's one of the songs that, you know, the Trying to Get to Heaven, Highlands, Not Dark Yet, and Standing in the Doorway are the four that Michael Gray, for example, you know, cited as the masterpieces, you know, initially, and Stands By Still, and a couple of the other writers. And those other three, it's very easy for me to see the distance between Standing in the Doorway and some of the others. I can feel it. And I think you're right, you know, in terms of the impact, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So it's very helpful. Do you know the Bonnie Raitt has covered it very well? I don't know if you've ever heard that. I think she's one of the few.
Yeah.
Some of these, you know, a lot of the blues guys like to do Time Out of Mind, Bob, now.
Yeah, well, it's the beginning of bluesy Bob, the beginning of Civil War era songwriter Bob. Not that he wasn't doing that previous to Time Out of Mind, but you can hear one of the things I did for the Dylan Center, which, you know, you mentioned, was I interviewed Taj Mahal. And you know, I think in his eyes, he sees Bob as a kind of a blues, you know, it's the traveling troubadour thing. You know, he doesn't see that much distance. He doesn't think of him, I think, necessarily as like a folk guy or an electric guy. I think if you pressed him on it, he would probably agree that Bob's just a blues guy. He's singing the blues.
Bob, I'm sure Bob would be happy to hear that.
I will tell you that never presume to know what Bob.
Well, that's probably better. Good advice. But in terms of covering Bob, since you were talking about that, I wanted to ask you this. I've always thought, I listened to a lot of covers, and we had Ray Padgett on, who's the Bob, you know, the covers expert of everything, let alone Bob. And we did a whole episode talking about it. But, you know, there are amazing Bob Dylan covers, and there are a lot of not amazing, you know, / terrible Bob Dylan covers. And you came closest to explaining something I've always thought about, which is, it seems to me as a listener that if you're focusing on the words, the cover's not going to be good. And if you're thinking about what it means, you know, you get it across, you know, and I always thought that's why Bob can change the words in songs, because Bob has got a thought and he can put it out five different ways. And any way he puts it out, it's the same thought. Does any of that make sense to you as a cover, as a guy who plays covers?
Yeah, absolutely. But look, you know, you may or may not remember this, But at our Dylan show this year, we did the Rod Stewart version of Forever Young, right? Because that was the way the singer who was doing it that night wanted to do it. And I had a blast. I never even considered playing it that way before. But, and you know, Dylan purists may scoff at that, but I'm betting Bob wouldn't. I mean, Bob certainly had to approve it, you know, because they changed the song so dramatically. You know, I think it's important, and I think it's important to see these songs as living, breathing things, so that there isn't a bad cover of a song. I mean, you can have, you know, look, you can have truly, you can walk into a bar in, you know, Southern New Jersey and see a terrible bar band playing Bob or Neil or Bruce, for that matter. But that doesn't mean that, and as a musician or as a music lover, it might offend your sensibility. But that doesn't mean that everybody else in there isn't having a good time. So I think you have to remember that, you know, this is, you know, these are meant, yes, there's a lot of meaning in these. And yes, Bob has a lot of ideas. And that's why we all gravitate toward him and have for so long. And there's this whole culture about trying to figure out what he's trying to say and what he thinks and what he means. But, you know, I think he wouldn't argue with me if I said, you know, at the end of the day, these are just pop songs. And the way for them to live and breathe is for not just Willie Nelson or Bonnie Raitt or Johnny Cash or, you know, great performers, or Adele for that matter, to do justice to them, but for them to live and breathe by, you know, the kid in the L train subway who has the detuned guitar, you know, between 6th and 7th Avenue doing Beatles tunes. They're not necessarily great, but he's smiling and he's loving doing it, and you know, he's giving it his all. And I just think we take this so seriously because it means so much to us. But I think we have to reconcile the fact that it doesn't mean that much to most people in the world. It's just background noise to most people. And so it's easier to just say, I veered off a little from your question. You can own it a little bit. You want me to re-answer it, but I think it's important to, you know, like I said earlier, you know, to take Bob as he wants to present himself to you, you know, to take these songs for what they are. You know, if you hear a 10-year-old kid at a you know, school talent show doing a Bob Dylan song, which I have, and bristle a little bit when they start, you also have to recognize that this kid put a lot into it. It meant something to them. They were trying to, you know, play with the big boys in a way. And this is how these songs survive the past time.
Yeah, I think
so.
I agree. Fair defense. No, as someone now, you know, talking about music in a different way, in a more public way, I've been trying to train myself to say I don't like it, not you know, it's not for me, and not it's terrible. You know, I spent 20 years or early part of my life just saying anything I didn't like was terrible. So I think your commentary is very useful. And YouTube videos, which I actually kind of enjoy, you know, there's endless Bob Dylan covers. There's dozens every week on the kind of very amateur, you know, scale. And I think looking at them the way you just said is really the way to look at them.
Right.
So Telltale Signs came out and gave us a little glimpse behind the Bob Dylan, Daniel Lanois stuff and some other takes. Red River Shores, the one that especially musicians seem to say was the one that got away. Anything in those extra couple songs or versions that made a big impact on you? So Telltale Signs came out and gave us a little glimpse behind the Bob Dylan, Daniel Lanois stuff and some other takes. Red River Shores, the one that especially musicians seem to say was the one that got away. Anything in those extra couple songs or versions that made a big impact on you?
Well, yeah. I mean, Red River Shores is really special. The live version of Called Iron Bounds, which you mentioned. You know, there's a couple of versions of Mississippi that are really, really cool. But I totally understand. With Mississippi, I understand why that wasn't working for Bob.
Oh, explain that to us.
You know? You know, I don't love, I've performed, I always kind of liked Mississippi okay on Love and Theft. And then I, you know, remember when Telltale Signs came out, the two versions that were on there, I mean, I just love Telltale Signs. I think that just such a special entry into the bootleg series. You know, it was, like you said, it was sort of a window into the process and completely different takes on this song that we knew really well. I think what happened, though, was during the pandemic, I was doing these weekly online concerts. And so, you know, I did them for almost 50 weeks. So, you know, I was doing different songs every week. And I did Mississippi a couple of times by request. And, you know, it's not, there's, for my money, there's not enough of a song there. You know, it's not of the caliber of some of the other ones. It's more a groove that Bob kind of riffs over, which he does really, really well. But if you're not Bob, you know, and granted, I didn't spend, these were songs I would just make a set list and then I would just play them. You know, I didn't like, you know, if there were songs that I really didn't know, I'd run them through once before I hit record or live. So it wasn't like I spent a whole lot of time thinking about this, but I remember in the middle of it thinking, ooh, this kind of doesn't go anywhere, you know? So it changed my relationship with the song. It wasn't a song I ever really loved, but Red River Shore is a different thing. It's sort of the Blind Willie McTell, I think, of Time Out of Mind. It's like, why would you not put that on there? However, you got to remember that was the beginning of the backlash of people making 70-minute albums. You know, and I think, you know, Time Out of Mind is already quite long.
It's 72. And
yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, he would have had to drop something. And, you know, I think I'm guessing again, but I think having these songs, you know, not edited, you know, like, 'cause some of them, you know, you could have dropped a verse here or there or whatever, but it would change the story and the dynamic of the song. And you would have had to lose Highland, right? And I think, you know, I'm just guess Cold Iron Bounds and or Highland. And I think, you know, I'm guessing again, but I think those songs were important for whatever reason to Bob Dylan to have on the record. And Red River Shore isn't all that different from some of the other songs on the album that are just as, if not more successful, that are sort of in the same ballpark. You know, it's like, if you're the artist, you see your babies a little bit differently. There was something about that one that didn't, you know, didn't speak to him in the same way the others did. I don't have any inside information on, you know, if Daniel Lanois weighed in on that, if the label weighed in on that, I bet that, but, you know, what the thinking was.
So you mentioned seeing Dylan perform a bunch of the songs from Time Out of Mind live, and you've seen that over the year. It's those are songs that have become really core to the set list. And even some of this rough and rowdy ways songs, you know, we've heard in the last year have been Love and Theft songs. They're very special songs in the way they're written, the way they're produced. What did you see on stage that either excited or surprised you, or what do you think about the way they've become a real core of his, you know, live set in the last 25 years?
I think Bob Dylan is keenly aware of not just the songs that have resonated with the public, but that were artistically successful. You know, I'm guessing he's able to see it as both the performer and the punter, you know, that these are songs that touched a nerve. You know, if you look at the albums that he plays the bulk of his set list from, they aren't necessarily the songs that, like, the very casual fan would maybe pick. But as I said to my brother, who hadn't seen him since the gospel years when he was going to see him in a couple of years ago, he's like, I always see bad reviews. I need to know what to expect. And I said, it's Bob Dylan. He's going to give you what he wants to give you. Just don't go with any preconceived notion. You know, I think if you're a casual fan, you're going to come on. You know, I sat at Forest Hills. They had a bunch of people from the country club in the row in front of us, and they were all drunk complaining about his voice. I thought it was one of the best shows I'd seen, you know, the night with him and Mavis Staples. I thought it was fucking fantastic. They were just drunk idiots. But I think he's really aware of the songs that are both meaningful and have been sort of absorbed within the zeitgeist. And I think there's something about the Time Out of Mind songs more so than some of those songs from Love and Theft or Together Through Life or Modern Times or some of the other records that maybe, you know, whether he prefers them or not or loves them more or not, is aware that they didn't have the same impact that those, you know, I mean, Lovesick, it was a big song. You know, whether you're Bob Dylan or, you know, I don't know, just some, you know, one hit wonder, if you were able to come up with Lovesick, you would be playing that song for the rest of your career. He has a lot of those to choose from, so it's a little bit different, but I think that's, you know, I think the thing that he has taken from that experience is, you know, I think also there's something about that Time Out of Mind shift in gears that really did inform the next 30 years, 25. That it's, you know, he started to be thought of as Bob Dylan again, capital letters, as the big dog in the pack, you know, making art at a level, you know, people always compare him to Neil, but nobody talks about Neil Young's records anymore the way they do, you know, Bob Dylan's records for the last 10 or 15 years, 20 years. You know, it put him back into the critical and artistic consciousness in a way that I think, whether he expected or not, he's certainly appreciative. I'm overthinking this. You know, you asked me a question. I'm trying to answer it the best I can. How Bob Dylan chooses his set list, who the fuck knows?
All right. So, Jeff, I want to thank you for all your time and insights and your many contributions to the Dylan community over the last number of years. It was really great to hear and talk to you today.
I'm a fan first and foremost. I was happy to be a part of this. And it's always an honor to be involved in anything Bob Dylan. So thanks for including me.
Thanks for listening.